Welcome back, baseball friends, to episode 74 of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available via the Nats GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the Baron of All Baseball Podcasts. The Nats GM Show is proudly sponsored by No Halftime and the No Halftime app. What is the No Halftime and No Halftime app, you ask? Well, let me fill you in a little bit. You're staring at your weekly fantasy opponent and thinking to yourself, I would love to challenge just one of his players, not his entire team, but your fantasy sports service doesn't allow you to. Now you can on the all-new No Halftime app. The No Halftime app allows you to create individual challenges using players or teams. For example, you can pit Bryce Harper versus Mike Trout, Miguel Cabrera versus Manny Machado, or Chris Davis versus Matt Kemp. Creating a challenge takes seconds, and accepting challenges is even easier. No Halftime challenges can be private or public and created for the MLB, NFL, NBA, NHL, PGA, and other sports. Join today and get started. Real money and fantasy supremacy awaits you. And now you can also try No Halftime for free with $0 challenges. Visit NoHalftime.com for more information and to download the No Halftime app for your iPhone or Android device. Receive a bonus by entering in the promo code NATSGM at signup. Receive a free t-shirt when you make a deposit. No Halftime, where the fantasy sports season never takes a break.
Hey, this is Ben Lindbergh, author of the best-selling book, The Only Rule Is It Has to Work, and you are listening to The Nats GM Show.
Welcome, everybody, to a live episode of the Nats GM Show, live from Sabre Seminar in Boston, Massachusetts. And I am proud to welcome a good friend of mine, a friend of the show, and author at Banished to the Pen, and also an author at Baseball Prospectus, Rob Maines. Rob, it's great to see you. I'm glad to be sitting across from you rather than on the phone talking, but it's great to see you. How are you?
It's great. Good seeing you, Ryan. This is our one time a year we get to talk face-to-face.
And it's really nice to really just get your opinion on what's going on with baseball. I've been so impressed with the work you've done in the last... Goodness, it's been a year now that you've been at BP? Pretty close.
But it started in March, so it's come around to a year next spring.
And definitely the stuff that you're doing is a must-read. If people aren't reading Rob's work, make sure you're getting to it. It's definitely a must-read every week, so...
Thanks.
I definitely want to give you the compliment. First place I wanted to start, and for those that are listening to this, I have Rob on, and we had some technical difficulties around the trade deadline. So had to get Rob back when I was sitting next to him and across from him. And first and foremost, the place I wanted to start with you is the Mark Melancon trade with the Nationals. As a Pirate fan, and you wrote a wonderful site for a long time covering the Pirates before you got promoted, so to speak. I wanted to get your take, first and foremost, on... I know it's been about 2 weeks now since the trade deadline. First of all, what are the Nationals getting in Mark Melancon?
Well, they're getting only 2 months of him, but they're getting, I think, one of the most dependable relievers in the National League, closers in the National League. He started last season slowly. He had a bad April. There were concerns about his velocity. There's concerns about his arm slot. People thought he was hurt. And ever since then, he's been lights out consistently. And he's not... Aroldis Chapman, Andrew Miller, Dylan Betances, strikes everybody out kind of guy, but we just saw a presentation today. He's one of the league leaders in broken bats so far this season, and he's just a real consistent outmaker, gets guys to hit the ball weakly when they hit it at all. And I think for the Nats, obviously there have been some issues at the back end of the bullpen. I think he's the solution for hopefully a run into October.
Yeah, I think we all knew about his cutter. I think everybody knows about Melancon's cutter. But the thing that has really impressed me in the couple of outings I've seen him is his curveball. He gets a lot of, he can throw it for strikes, but also he gets a lot of weak contact on that, a lot more than even I'm expect that you used to, or you don't expect to see that much weak contact.
Yeah, he's been a really consistent guy, just fooling hitters. Not swing and miss all the time, but certainly not getting solid contact off what he offers.
Now let me have you give the Pirates' perspective, both you as the expert fan and how the fan base looked at that trade. Was it, man,
you know, we're not that far out of it and we're trading our closer, or was it, yeah, that was probably the right move to make at the time kind of thing?
Well, you know, it's interesting you ask that, because we spoke, as you said, right the day of the deadline.
Literally an hour after the deadline.
And that was what? That was just a couple days after they'd done the trade.
Yeah.
And I think the initial reaction from the fan base was exactly what you suggested. Is this a white flag? You know, here's our closer, we're getting rid of him. And then, you know, kind of the more rational minds, there's some real good writers in the Pittsburgh area, pointed out that this was a guy they weren't going to be able to keep anyway. They got some good pitchers in return. And Tony Watson, who moved in the closers, were all certainly, another guy, it was more this year. He had an okay April, and then other than two disastrous outings against the Angels in June, he had a sub-1 ERA. And so it seemed to be ready to step in the closer role. It subsequently did blow a save, and so people were a little less sure of it. But I think now that we're a couple weeks looking back at it, I think fans have realized two things. One, this probably, though we'll talk about this, is not a year that the Pirates are going to be going to the postseason. If they do, it's going to be as a wild card. Nobody's catching the Cubs, obviously. So, you know, to be able to get some controllable assets for somebody that wasn't going to be part of the team next year, when you do have in Watson, I think, a pretty capable ninth-inning guy, I think it's a trade that people were comfortable with. Some of the other deals the Pirates did, I think, a little less so, but this one I think people are all right with.
And let me take that segue, if I can, because you gave it to me, and I'm going to take it perfectly, of what was the feeling on some of the other deals? I know the Liriano deal was, I mean, basically a pure salary dump. I mean, I know Drew Hutchinson's, some people like him, some people don't. But to give away two prospects and Liriano to basically clear that money, I mean, what's been the reaction in Pittsburgh of the other deals? Let's...
Well, that one in particular was controversial, because you and I spoke right after the deadline, and all that you and I had seen was the headline, Liriano for Hutchison. And I thought, hey, that's pretty good. What we didn't know, because it hadn't been announced yet by MLB Trade, or disclosed on MLB Trade Rumors, is that they gave up two good prospects, a good catcher, Reese McGuire, and an outfielder, Harold Ramirez. And I think that the fact that they gave up two prospects in order to get the Jays to take the rest of this year and the next year of Liriano's salary, there's a panoply of opinions about this. I was speaking today at the conference to Mike Farron. He thought it made sense. He didn't think either of those guys were going to fit in with the Pirates. I think it was a little steep price. I get it. And Hutchison is type of guy that, you know, whenever you see a pitcher who's had limited success go to the Pirates, you got to figure that Ray Searard saw something he thinks he can magically fix.
1,000%.
And that could very well be the case. And so when you do a salary dump, you know, you have to give up, you have to give the receiving team something more than just the player. You got to give them other players to make up for it. My only gripe with it is that Liriano's salary wasn't that extreme. It was $12, $13 million. And I thought they gave up a fair amount to get it, a guy who I think is going to be kind of a low, you know, a low power but decent contact outfielder, and a catcher who at least looks like he's got a good glove. Whether the bat's going to play, we don't know. But, you know, in the meantime, you have a pitcher who, and I wrote about this for BP, I think might be broken in Liriano. And, you know, the league sort of got the memo at the beginning of the year. He wants you to chase. Don't swing at anything outside the zone. He's been horrible this season. So it made sense to trade him. I thought the price was maybe a little bit high, but it was, again, a guy that was not going to be helping the team this year. And the two youngsters that went away weren't going to help the team this year either.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I like Hutchinson as a, you know, lottery ticket, if you want to say it like that. And I understood it if it was just Liriano for Hutchinson. But throwing in the two prospects, and you can argue their ceiling or what have you, but I thought that was, like you say, it was a pretty steep price for a small market team, although clearing $15 million is still...
Yeah.
Clearing $15 million. So what is the state of the franchise now with the Pirates? It looks like it's going to be maybe a 15% chance they make the playoffs this year. I don't know. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but
yeah,
it certainly they aren't in their favor.
Yeah.
But the long term, it feels like it's pretty good.
Yeah, I think that this is, and I think Travis Sawchuk, who wrote Big Data Baseball, he had a piece, I think last week, saying that this was, that early in the season, I must have missed this, that Neil Hutchinson said this was going to be kind of a transition year for the club anyway, in that you had, you know, not so much that you had, not so much like, say, the Yankees, who, you know, have salary coming off, but some guys on the farm who are making the transition to the majors but may not be ready this season, will be next year. Jameson Taillon pitched a great game for the club on, what day is it? Today's Saturday, so it was Thursday. Josh Bell came up briefly. Looks like John Jaso may not be back next season just because Bell looked pretty good in his limited edition at first base. So I think the club is set up. Austin Meadows has got the call up to AAA. The Pirates do not currently need an outfielder, obviously, when you're left to right Marte, McCutchen, and Polanco. They're probably going to after the 2018 season when McCutchen is going to be a free agent and is virtually certain to go someplace else. You know, there's a thought that he could get traded as well. So I think the team is kind of positioning itself with the next wave of young prospects for a big run the next couple of years. The thing that could help them this year is during the next couple months, they play a lot of games against the Reds and the Brewers. Unfortunately for them, the Cardinals play a lot of games against the Reds and Brewers as well, and the Cardinals are ahead of them.
I'm going to put you in the GM position. End of the season, I'm going to give you 24 hours as the GM of the Pirates. What are you doing this offseason to take them from this transition year and try to get them? Maybe you can't quite compete with the Cubs, but you've got to compete with them in the division. So what are you doing? I'm giving you the GM job.
Well, here's why that's an easy job for this winter. Correct me if I'm wrong. There's, like, no good free agents this
Nobody.
Winter.
Nobody. Yeah, I mean, even the guys that were supposed to be good, like Carlos Gomez, are getting DFA'd
right
now.
Yeah, yeah. So the decision on which big-name free agent to sign, we don't have to make that decision. I would look into moving McCutchen. I mean, granted, you're trading them after a bad year, but I don't think this is the same thing as, say, the Dodgers trying to trade Yasiel Puig when he's looked completely lost at the plate and has been a clubhouse cancer. I mean, this is a McCutchen who started the year with an injured thumb.
Really struggled the first 6 weeks or so.
Yeah, well, and he hasn't done a hell of a lot better since. But, you know, there's no reason to believe that he's forgotten how to be a great hitter. And if I could move him for some controllable starting pitching arms, I think that could make sense. Just because, you know, he's got two more years in Pittsburgh in all likelihood. Given that ticking clock, every extra, if you assume you're going to lose him at the end of 18, every extra month you've got him, his value is going to go down. There's a school of thought that says at the trade deadline, pitchers become more valuable, but position players don't necessarily. So it might be the right time to at least see what you can get for him. If you could get like a solid starter and maybe a couple prospects who are close, you know, major league level starter, a couple decent prospects, I could see doing that just because they do have the reinforcements in the farm system. Austin Meadows has been hitting the ball well.
Well, and to that point, with the free agent market being so weak this offseason, you could see a team who needs to upgrade. You know, hey, we need that one bat in our lineup. You could get a king's ransom for them right now. I mean, we're seeing prospects, you know, or have gone from, you know, everybody's got to keep them to now we're getting dealt away. I mean, and that was really the surprising thing. I'd love to move just to the trade deadline a little bit. Is it was really interesting how many prospects got moved. And maybe not the elite of the elite, but that next tier, we saw a fair amount of guys. Gleyber Torres and a lot of guys of that ilk.
Clint Frazier,
another great name.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of like, well, we're in 2016. Wasn't it just 2 years ago that the A's traded for Lester?
Almost 2 years. Yes.
And that was, who did they give up for him?
Addison Russell and Billy McKinnon.
Yeah, and Billy McKinnon. So, and granted, it's because the Royals got really lucky in one game that people look at it that way.
Correct.
But that trade is looked upon as being sort of a failure, mortgaging your future for something uncertain. So I'm surprised that, you know, we're kind of back there. I mean, all of a sudden, Milwaukee, the Yankees, they've gone from what I hear that I think was it MLB Pipeline now rates them 1-2 in the majors.
They're both easily top five.
Yeah, and good job on both those front offices for being able to do that. Because you're right, it seemed like everyone was grossly overvaluing prospects, and we've gone really like what 6 months, not even a year. I agree with you. I'm surprised by some of the names that got moved.
Let me ask you a little bit about the Yankees as well. A-Rod's been in the news and kind of the big subject.
Yeah.
I will be kind of candid in the fact that being in D.C. has shielded me a little bit from this media circus storm, but I don't know. I feel like A-Rod kind of got, I don't know, a little bit of a raw deal the last couple of months. What's your take on the A-Rod situation?
I agree with you. I mean, the most laughable, A-Rod episode was Girardi saying that he didn't want to play him because, you know, because the team, and he's right, the team is still kind of in contention for a wild card spot. And certainly, you know, they don't want to lay down for some of the other teams they're playing who are also in contention. They have a obligation
to
field a competitive team. But here's the thing. They gave 670, I think, plate appearances to, I mean, an all-time great, but probably the worst shortstop in the American League. Just a year ago, for a, you know,
and nonstop, kept him at shortstop.
Yeah, for a nonstop farewell tour. So that just didn't wash. And he, you know, the thing about Rodriguez, I think that those of us who are sort of more sabermetrically inclined don't come down on him as hard as the general public or the New York media or people like that do. But I kind of just hope that we'll stop having to read A-Rod headlines for a while, but it seems like it's inevitable.
I feel like that's a good point. I also feel like the guys that watched his career were a little older than maybe some of the writers that are out there. I feel like appreciate how good he was when he was in the early part of his career.
Yeah.
And maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I feel like at a certain point, everybody in baseball was doing something. So to penalize, to make him he and Bonds,
right.
to make them the poster right. children negatively right. of this whole wave just seems really unfair to me.
Well, and the thing about Rodriguez is, he seems to have become sort of a model since the last couple of years, but he had a difficult personality.
Correct. He was not a nice guy.
Yeah. Well, and he seemed just kind of weird in a lot of ways. But he doesn't get credit for signing with the Yankees at a time when he was clearly the best shortstop in baseball. And the Yankees had a guy, and not to knock Jeter. Jeter was a phenomenal player. But he wasn't Alex Rodriguez, either at the plate or with the glove.
Rodriguez had won the Gold Glove the year before.
And Rodriguez is the guy who moved. And he doesn't get credit for really taking one for the team by moving, when really that should have been Jeter to have moved off the position. But no one's you put Rodriguez and Jeter in the same sentence and the Daily News starts, you know, firing darts at you.
Well, and I think we also forget, and I'm stealing this, I think, from Sam and Ben in their podcast this week, but he had 55 WAR. As a Yankee.
Yeah.
I mean, in 12 years, I mean, that's a phenomenal player.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
he won two MVPs,
yeah.
I believe. I think he won a ring with them or two. I mean, we forget how good he was because of all the other stuff.
Right.
But he was one of the five best players I've ever seen in my lifetime. And I think that's probably...
Yeah, I'd say that.
Yeah. Next topic I want to ask you about is Yasiel Puig.
Boy.
What happened? I mean, this guy was one of the more exciting players in baseball 2 years ago. Maybe one of the 10 most valuable in terms of just overall for the youth, for the selling tickets, for hitting.
Right.
And now he's in AAA, and it feels like the Dodgers would give him away for a hot dog right now. I mean, what do you do? What's your, you know, week? I don't even know where to begin.
Well, you know, somebody today asked a question about Gene Segura. And Gene Segura, I think, this year is probably the most prominent change of scenery guy
You certainly, know? Easily one of the top three. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And Puig sounds like he's in the same sort of position. The thing is, Puig's ceiling is a lot higher than Gene Segura's. I think the Dodgers are really kind of stuck here in that he's certainly not helping the club. He's not on the club.
Right.
I think they would move him. But talk about moving a guy at the absolute nadir of his value. I don't really know what they can do. It seems, you know, whatever agent Rodriguez worked with the year he was suspended, where he came back and became, you know, nice A-Rod and, you know, great teammate and all that sort of stuff, Puig should hire that guy. At least he can change the narrative about himself.
But it feels like he needs to get out of L.A., maybe to a smaller market where he can disappear a little bit. And then, I mean, I think he's a good guy. I just think that the big market and a change of scenery is, like you said, is...
Yeah. Where did I hear there's rumors that the White Sox might be interested with him, sort of with the idea that Jose Abreu might be able to take him under his wing?
And I could see that. They're the second team in Chicago, but he would have plenty of opportunity. Right. There's some offense there that's a great hitting park. I mean, I could see that as a good fit. You know, that actually... That's not a bad call, actually.
Yeah, it's just...
Would you gamble on him?
Dodgers.
For your team?
All right. If my team's the Pirates, no, because we're filled up in the outfield. But if I were a team, well, like the White Sox, or like, you know, anybody that's got a hole in the outfield,
Yeah. Why not? Believe me, if I were the Braves or somebody like that, I would gamble. He's one of those, we've said it a couple times now, change of scenery guys. But those guys exist, and they really do. You know, so... I think the final topic I want to get to you is just I want to talk a little bit about Sabre Seminar. We're here. We've done with the first day. They tend to load the presentations up a little bit on Saturday. Just what was your favorite presentation or presentations today?
Well, I'll tell you one thing I liked a lot. I once met with John Thorne, the official historian of baseball, and he wrote, this is a roundabout way of answering your question. He wrote a book in the 1980s called The Hidden Game of Baseball. That along with the Bill James Baseball Abstract, was the first serious look at sabermetrics. You know,
must read.
At analytically looking at the game. And I asked him, I said, what do you like, you know, what are you doing currently sabermetrically? He said, I just like stories. He has a blog at the MLB site called Our Game, Stories of the Past. I like stories, too. And I thought the most entertaining story that we got today, and it's sort of my favorite moment probably at the conference, was Dan Dombrowski explaining that a lot of people listening to this probably don't know what happens when the leagues expand. When the leagues expand, when they add new teams, and this was back in 96, was
that
it?
That was my guess. Maybe 94. I mean, it was a while.
I think it was 95. I think it was right after the strike, maybe. But anyhow, when the Marlins and Rockies it was the Marlins
and the Rockies.
It was the Rockies, yeah. Marlins, Rockies.
David Neath was the first pick.
Yes.
And Preston Wilson, I believe, was the second.
Right. Well, the way that it worked then, and this has been true of other expansion teams, is that teams were allowed to reserve a certain number of players on their 40-man roster, and then anybody else could get drafted, but as soon as you lost somebody, you could put a cover on all your other guys. You didn't have to lose a second player. And what we found out today was that the Rockies, with their, I think it said third round pick, took Brad Ausmus, who was a catcher with the Yankees. And the Yankees then put a blanket over everybody else. Nobody else could get drafted. The Marlins were next, and they wanted to draft the Yankees pitcher Mariano Rivera. So if the Rockies had not drafted Brad Ausmus, Mariano Rivera would not have been Mariano Rivera.
Yeah, you know, who knows where Yankees. He is. And where is the Yankees' legacy now? Yeah. I mean, without him closing those games all those years, where would they have been?
Yeah. So I thought that was just a phenomenal story to have heard.
I agree with you.
I had not heard that. You know, I thought that we heard from the assistant GM Brian Minitti of the Diamondbacks, and I thought he was really candid.
I thought he was extraordinarily honest.
Because a lot of times what happens is, it's like when your local reporter asks a GM something, and the GM used a lot of words to not answer the question.
Yeah.
And I thought we got some interesting answers from him.
I was going to say, along with that, Tom Tippett this morning, I thought he was fantastic as well. And he talked a little bit, maybe this is a little personal as a Nats fan, but he talked about the year that Jason Worth and Carl Crawford were both free agents.
Yeah.
And how much the Worth contract kind of played into their negotiations. And he said, you know, we thought we were going to get Crawford. We could get him for 5 years and $95 million, or at least under 100.
Right.
And then Worth signs for $7,126, so they have to go to $7,140 to get him. And it's, you know, you have these great laid out plans in this offseason, and then one thing can happen, and all that extra money you thought you had is now gone for the whole offseason. And I thought it was interesting. He was a little candid that said he would have preferred Worth.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't totally put it that way, but he said, I would have preferred the right-handed bat. And I thought that was... But I think in this setting, they're a little more honest than they would be in general.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I go to the Sabre Analytics Conference in Phoenix, which is a bigger conference. I mean, there's more people there. And partly it's because the format of that isn't Q&A like what we had. But I thought we got some real candid responses. And Tom Tippett is always a lot of fun to hear. His presentation this year was... He looked back at 2011, you know, the famous chicken and beer year when the Sox collapsed at the end of the year, and talked about sort of what all went wrong, and then did point out that there are some parallels to the 2016 Red Sox. Not suggesting the same things are going to happen, but, you know, got off to a lightning-fast start with probably unsustainably good levels of offense and a starting pitching staff that makes you kind of worry a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how they're going to keep doing it unless David Price gets really hot down the stretch, but they're in a tough way right now. I mean, with Toronto's playing pretty well and Baltimore's knocking the cover off the baseball.
Baltimore, I'm not the only guy to say this. Baltimore, I get wrong every year. As I look at them, I say they don't have any pitching. All they do is hit home runs. They strike out a lot. They don't get on base. And, well, Manny Machado's amazing. But
best player, not enough people talk about.
Right. But I think that's a team where I'm a big Showalter fan, and I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, it's sort of like Bobby Cox every year. They take more players away from him, and the Braves still would win. Showalter, I think, keeps pulling rabbits out of his hat year after year.
And they keep building a bullpen year after year. I know finding Britton has been great, but even Brock this year, and, you know, Day struggled a little bit, but they made him into a reliever. I mean, they've done a really nice job of really building that organization.
Yeah.
And they pick it, too, on defense. I think that's something, particularly in the infield, that doesn't get
talked
about enough.
That's a pretty amazing infield.
Their outfield defense is terrible, but their infield defense is great. So, you know, I could sit here and we'll probably grab a beer after this and talk a little more, but I think this is a good place for us to cut it off here, and I'd love to give you a spot here for your plugs where everybody can find you on Twitter, where they can find your work online, and we got to have everybody who's listening to this find your work. So, plug away.
Well, thanks. And also, Brian, I want to thank you for having me on. This is one of the best podcasts, I think, about baseball that I listen to. You're a great interviewer, and I really enjoy hearing you talk to a lot of the personalities who are much more prominent than me about the game. But people looking for me, I'm Cran, C-R-A-N, _boy, at Twitter, and you can find me both at Banished to the Pen and at Baseball Prospectus.
And where did Cranboy come from? I don't think I've ever asked you this.
Yeah, and I don't give a lot of people a completely straight answer. It's a nickname that my son came up with. Our son. My wife always gives me grief when I use the singular pronoun. That our son came up with me a while ago. And, you know, it's more distinctive than just being Rob Maines.
That's very true. Well, Rob, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure. You know, one of my favorite people to talk to. It's just a wonderful opportunity to get to spend a couple minutes with you, and I hope we can do it again next year.
I look forward to it.
Thank you so much.